This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the Black is Back Coalition held a national conference on this year's elections, where bar editor Margaret Kimberly gave a scathing analysis of Hillary Clinton and her husband. And another bar writer, Danny Haifong, explains what a President Saunders or President Trump can and cannot do. But first, Mississippi's Republican state government is trying to strip its mostly black capital city, Jackson, of control over its airports and other revenue-producing properties. The state also seems eager to seize the city's water system. We spoke with Kali Okuno of Cooperation Jackson, the political organization that elected Chakwe Lumumba as arguably the most radical black mayor in the country back in 2013. But Mayor Lumumba died the next year, and now his supporters are fighting from the outside. Kali Okuno says the Mississippi Republican Party is determined to crush all possibility of black political and economic power in Jackson. He calls it the Confederate Spring.
We are at a very critical stage in the battle. Republican Party, which in Mississippi is, for all intents and purposes, a Tea Party, an independent Tea Party, just so folks are clear. Libertarian, reactionary to the core, racist to the core. They have fundamentally kind of got their act together and united on a program basically just dismantling Jackson. Now, parts of this program have been made public, have been around in various forms and fashions for several years, but there were some fundamental disagreements amongst themselves that really kind of kept them from pursuing this dismantling kind of agenda for throttle. They've definitely gotten their act together in the 2 years since Chokwe Lumumba passed, and it is very clear that they use his passing as an opportunity, and they use his being elected as a wake-up call. And from that, they basically united their forces and resolved their differences, and now they're trying to advance in such a manner that another Chokwe or someone similar, same politics or similar politics, cannot emerge to utilize the strength of the numbers of the black community and the assets controlled by the city of Jackson and what they potentially could yield in a transformative process. They're trying to make sure that does not happen again. So we are definitely being encircled. Within the next several hours, we anticipate that Governor Phil Bryant is going to, with a stroke of his pen, seize the airports of Jackson. Jackson has two airports. One is a main kind of travel airport. The other one's more personal travel airport, the older one. They're going to seize those. And the seizure of those is about profit, future profit in particular, but also control, strategic control of vital assets and resources in an area, and particularly the Harkins Field, the smaller one, is being used as a means to kind of cut off different parts of the black community as it's tied to other development projects, one being the medical corridor project and the other one this new capital corridor project, which are completely under the control of the governor. And what they basically do with those two projects is kind of create these little pockets of Bantustans, in effect, with parts of North Jackson, which were predominantly black working class, and parts of West Jackson and South Jackson, which is where the black working class is concentrated in the city of Jackson. So it's in a final stage, at least it's kind of execution in law so that they can seize all of these assets and then say that it was done through a credible and a democratic process. And then they're going to move in the next phase, which is bringing in the capital, which then brings in the gentrifiers, which then forces displacement of critical parts of the population, And with the displacement, critical aspects of the political project that we have been pursuing will be negated. That is their plan. That is their hope. But we are still resisting. And on several fronts, we know that the court system, given its present composition, going to kind of undo what they have done this legislative session. But we also know that in part, you know, them advancing this LGBTQ hate bill, for example, we know that's more of a tactic than it is a strategy. They know that's going to get struck down in the federal court, but they're using it as a long-term strategy to, A, influence the national stage of elections and trying to get a Republican elected president of the United States. And they're also using that as a means to influence more strategically in the long-term battle the Supreme Court, so they can put someone on the court to replace Anton Scalia, who will overturn the equal marriage laws that have been enacted over the past several years. So they're working on a national strategy, not just a local one. But they're clear that in order for them to gain their position and solidify their position, they have to destroy progressive little bastions like Jackson, Mississippi, have been in the past several years.
So here we have a 70% black city, but the state, in the form of the state Republican Party, is moving to sever that black city's potential or actual revenue-producing areas from it.
That's right. That's right. And Jackson is over 80% black. But they have a full-on plan of dismembering this city. The airport, really, in some respects, is a trial run, because that's something that they also know is likely to be tied up in court, following the example of what's been taking place in Charlotte for the past 4 or 5 years. So they're also anticipating that. But I think the larger piece and the larger prize that they're really seeking is Jackson's water system. And so, you know, we would urge folks in the audience to be mindful that we do have a Flint-type situation here and have had one for years, and have been putting some information out about it, but it wasn't until the kind of a real major faux pas that happened up in Flint that this issue is starting to gain some major national attention. But the kind of the rot and decay of the U.S. empire's internal infrastructure has been going on for decades now. But the water piece here in Jackson, ours is a little bit different than Flint. In our case, the city has a relatively state-of-the-art, top-notch water treatment facility, one that was built not too long ago. So the issue is not the water treatment or the water source per se. The issue is the 100-plus-year-old lead pipes that provide drinking water to most of the city and that provide drinking water to virtually all of the surrounding white suburban communities. So they want to seize that strategic asset because of the amount of revenue that it generates within the region. And they also want to break being dependent upon a black municipality and its ability to utilize a resource like water to kind of raise greater revenues or to make other kind of political demands on these suburbs. So they're going at this very strategically to try to seize this asset from the city, which may be likely because they're using the water crisis now as a justification of saying, well, you know, those black folks can't manage it. They can't take care of it. So you need to give it over to a regional power or you need to privatize it. These are all the arguments that are now being used on their side to kind of exploit the crisis as it exists. But they're using this, you know, as a means to basically destroy Jackson. And why do I say that? Right now, 42% of Jackson's revenue, total revenue for the general operation of its overall budget, comes from the sale of water to residents in the city of Jackson and to those folks who live in those white suburban communities. So that's roughly almost half of the city of Jackson's budget. That if they take that, there's going to be very little left for anyone to manage here, to try to fix the roads, to provide other social services. So we really have to question, once the airport is gone, once the water system is gone, once they seize control of Jackson State University as an economic engine, the downtown redevelopment projects that they're ushering through as an economic engine, and tied that all with the medical corridor, you can see there will be very little left. Even with a black political majority, there'll be very little left to actually govern and to draw the resources from to deliver goods and services to this community.
So they would be allowed to pauperize the city in terms of its economic viability and blame it on an 80% black majority, which will not have any authority over those areas.
That is the plan. That is the plan. Being executed with some military precision. Now, the one thing that we are really pressing on is that there's some major faults to their logic that can be exploited. One of the other things that they're really putting forward, and what we've been calling the Confederate Spring, one of the things that they put forward is a bill that basically cuts all of the state's ability to raise major revenue. They passed this, given their sworn allegiance to the neoliberal capitalist social order and means of kind of extracting profits by plundering state resources. So they've agreed to that. What it essentially means is that very shortly, this state is going to have some critical budget shortfalls. And they're going to use that, we know, to try to privatize education and things of that nature by saying, hey, you know, these things are being run ineffectively and efficiently. We need to try something new. We know their strategy in that regard. But what it's going to do, I think, that we can exploit for something like this Capitol Corridor Improvement District, as they call it. We call it the Downtown Annexation Initiative. What it's going to do is cut off some critical resources that the governor could be able to use to gentrify the area. So it's like they're moving, but they're not thinking all the way straight, because with their ideological focus on trying to make government so small that what they're saying that they can, you can drown it in the bathtub, that has limits for them as it has limits for us. So we are really trying to utilize that and hit them where they have some shortfalls and hit them where it hurts. You see, as a result of the LGBTQ hate bill, that there are already a good number of corporations that are lining up, and even states that are lining up, state governments that are lining up to boycott the state. This is something that our forces have been strategically calling for and preparing for as a tool to kind of hit back, because we know they respond to their pockets. They don't respond to moral arguments, and they don't respond to political weakness. So we are going to use this against them in the strategic long term to salvage, you know, what we can of Jackson's economic access, you know, what they can strategically enable with sound political leadership and the social movement backing and driving that leadership. The battle's not over. You know, even though it's at a critical point, the battle's not over. From our vantage point, because of this supermajority that they have in the legislature, they were sure to win this round of the battle, but they got a little something coming that I don't think they fully anticipated, and I think we're going to be scoring some major victories of our own in the course of the next several months, particularly if we can get our allies throughout the country and throughout the world to join us in this call to boycott, sanction, and to support Jackson in his campaign. You know, we are really targeting on our main fronts, Rankin County and Madison County, and we're going to ask everyone throughout the globe to support us in that. But we're also launching basically what's called a Buy Jackson campaign and trying to use that to transform and bolster our economy, you know, local economy in the long term. So we're asking everybody to give us some support on that. And if we can get it, we'll be able to withstand this little short-term shock and to be able to hurt them, to hit them where it hurts.
You seem to be saying that even the gentrifiers actually need government support in terms of their projects, their revitalizations and such, as they call it. We know that means black removal, but that requires government assistance and subsidies. And so they're in some ways working at cross purposes by weakening the powers of government to provide those kinds of subsidies.
Exactly. Those projects don't advance without government sponsorship, point blank. They cannot advance without some level of government sponsorship. Not just government support, but government sponsorship in the form of various types of subsidization. You know, the biggest thing here is they're trying to use tax credits, low-income credits that are sponsored both by the state government and the federal government. Their objective always is to use as little of their own capital as possible and have the public pay for the redevelopment slash gentrification slash black removal projects that they have going forward. But if they cut off their ability, particularly on a state level, to be able to provide any relief and any aid and any sponsorship for these initiatives, then they're really kind of cutting off their nose to spite their face. So their logic has some errors, it has some flaws in it, and we're going to exploit it.
You also highlighted the disaster capitalism dangers that are raised by the hue and cry over lead-based pipes. That is,
right,
that these forces can use the righteous fears that people have about lead pipes, which are virtually all over the country, as a pretext for privatization of water all over the country.
That's right. They're definitely going to use that and already are marching their forces to use that, not to support the improvement of the system, but to support the program of the privatization of the system. That's their ultimate aim and objective. So we have to be very clear in coming up with some clear political counters to this. You know, in the state of Mississippi, we unfortunately don't have some of the recourse that is now available in Flint, Michigan, where the folks there are beginning to take the charge of actually suing the governor. That's a little bit removed from us. But there are other means that we're going to try and develop other strategies to secure the system, improve it, and expand it, and make sure that it remains under the democratic control of this majority black city.
And finally, what's happening in Jackson in terms of the state taking over large sectors of the economy in Jackson and whole parts geographically of the city? That really isn't that different from what's been happening for decades in cities across the country, where boards and agencies and quasi-public entities, most of which are staffed by corporate managers, actually run many of the functions of cities in terms of port authorities and airport authorities and all kinds of authorities and agencies.
Exactly right. I mean, I think the only difference here is they have taken some of the best practices that have been innovated on the reactionary side of seizing control, seizing assets, and seizing resources, you know, from experiments all throughout the country. They've taken the best of those, the most effective of those, and they've concentrated them all together and put them together in a strategic suite to execute here in Jackson all at the same time. I think that's the difference. Like, we're getting a full-on assault. And so instead of a kind of a piecemeal chipping away, they decided to put it all together in the one bullet and hit us with it at one time. So that's what we're facing right now in Jackson. It's not like seizing or annexing the downtown is something new. We just witnessed that just a couple of hundred miles down south in Louisiana, where they used that on the heels of the disaster caused in part by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, right? So we've seen that. This community is very familiar with New Orleans and what happened there. So it's not like there's no knowledge or this kind of came out of the blue. It's just how they presented it, how they used the newly acquired supermajority in Congress that they have to just make a full-on assault. And now it's time for us to get our act together and hit back.
That was Kelly Okuno of Cooperation Jackson and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. In New York City's Harlem this weekend, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations held a national conference on the elections and black self-determination. The conference explored whether this election season has opened up new possibilities for a radical, independent black politics. Margaret Kimberly, a Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist, was one of the speakers.
A few days ago, Bill Clinton made headlines by helping his wife look worse than she had already done on her own. They are a tag team, and every day, one of them volunteers to put a foot firmly in their mouth and remind everyone how awful they are. On this particular occasion, Bill Clinton was interrupted by protesters who rightly pointed out that his 1994 crime bill vastly increased the numbers of black people behind bars. But Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, reacted angrily and accused the protesters of defending gang members and killers and drug dealers. And before this, I had already written that if he wants to help his wife, he should stay off the campaign trail altogether. But he won't, and keeps proving me right. But there's a bigger point to be made about the Clintons and Bernie Sanders and how black people respond to them and to the Democratic Party. And I have to confess, I guess I'm in a church I should, but I and other people still voted for Bill Clinton. And this was after the crime bill, after the welfare reform bill, after all of the horrible policies that he inflicted on the country and the world. I was that typical fearful black voter, and I voted for Democrats no matter what, and I was not alone. Now, having awakened from that slumber, I'm proud to say that now I don't feel the burn, and I'm not with Hillary, and I won't be voting for either one of them in November. But I also argue that voting for Clinton isn't any worse than voting for Barack Obama. And I'm here to say that we must stop this losing proposition altogether. We have to stop voting for the Democrats. And that will be the first step towards liberation and self-determination for black people. When Bernie Sanders began the election season with a draw in Iowa and a victory in New Hampshire, the foolishness that substitutes for black politics today came out into the open in all of its awful glory. It was just ridiculous. First, there was a photo from 50 years ago showing a white man at a protest. And there was this whole thing, was it Bernie Sanders, was it not Bernie Sanders? And he wasn't the one in that particular photo. But there was a photo of him at another rally, it really was him. And yes, he was active with CORE in Chicago, and Hillary's family were Republicans, and she was a Goldwater girl. And this information may be interesting to some people, but frankly, there's nothing there. It's not unusual for people of their age to have been in marches or to have been raised by Republicans but become a Democrat. The real issue is what does any of this have to do with black people? And at this moment, the Congressional Black Caucus was true to form, and they, as for the reasons that Glenn just stated, they stuck with Hillary Clinton, and they got their political action committee to endorse her. Now, that is their arm which lobbies with big pharma and cigarette makers, but it's a distinction without a difference. The endorsement gave the appearance of CBC members endorsing Clinton, and they didn't disappoint. Charles Rangel, whose district we're now in, said that he didn't know any black people who knew Bernie Sanders. John Lewis, who gets a lot of mileage out of being called a civil rights icon, said he didn't know Bernie Sanders from back in the day, but he did know Bill and Hillary, except not really at that moment, but he did meet them later on. Then, of course, Al Sharpton, when he senses somebody else might be president, he rears his ugly head, and he had lunch with Sanders at Sylvia's, Sanders looked a little uncomfortable being in Al's embrace, and he ought to. But all of this is part of the hoax that we go through every 4 years, the hoax of the presidential election. And I call it a hoax because it gives an illusion that the U.S. is a democracy and that the people have a voice. But we know that it is no such thing, because we never get what we want from the political system. And the second part of that hoax concerns black people in particular. We live in fear of many things that are not issues for other people. We're afraid of the police, afraid of losing our jobs, and we'll hear later today we're afraid of being kicked out of our homes by gentrification. But when election years come around, we are most afraid of Republicans, as Glenn Ford just described them, the white people's party. And we have reason to be fearful, but feeling as if we have no recourse other than to continue in allegiance to the Democrats when they do us no good is certainly no answer to our problems. This year we have an interesting situation with the rise of Bernie Sanders. One candidate was declared the front runner because of fundraising prowess and name recognition and a seeming certainty of victory. And of course, I mean Hillary Clinton. And that perceived front runner status made her a favorite among the always anxious black voter. But Hillary being Hillary, she wore out her welcome as soon as the campaign season began. Her high-handedness, her tone deafness, and the history of her own and her husband's corruption made discerning voters think twice and take a look at Bernie Sanders. Now, Sanders has called himself a socialist. Now he refers to himself as a social democrat. But he stated for the record that he's not in favor of public ownership of the means of production, so he isn't a socialist at all. He's just a democrat. But the party has moved so far to the right over the years that anyone sounding like most Democrats sounded 40 or 50 years ago is able to call themselves a leftist, even when they're no such thing. Now, Hillary Clinton is leading in the delegate count mostly because of overwhelming victory in the southern states. There are few, if any, white Democrats in the South, so that means black voters stuck with the status quo. Sanders' supporters then proceeded to ask what was wrong with those crazy black people. Don't they love Bernie like they do? But it's the wrong question to ask if we're interested in self-determination. The bigger issue is why we're still allowing ourselves to be herded like sheep into the arms of the Democrats again. We have so little to show for being the most loyal constituency that they have. And that question should be our emphasis, not trying to figure out if Bernie is better than Hillary. In any case, saying that he is damning with faint praise and leading down the path of the impossible, which is to try to find a better Democratic politician. But the Sanders phenomenon is useful in that it lays bare the hollowness of what pauses for the left in the United States. Even people who had supposedly staked out a position on the left are showing their true fair-weather colors. The New York primary is going to be held in a couple of weeks, and I noticed something interesting happening. New York has a closed primary, and that means only registered Democrats can vote for Hillary or Bernie. And as that deadline approached, I began to see that people who were registered as Green Party members were publicly stating they were going to change their affiliation to the Democrats in order to vote for Bernie. Now, if you're registered as a Green, why do you want to vote for a Democrat at all? And you do that because you aren't really a Green. You're just a disaffected Democrat who lives in hope that somewhere, somehow, someone more likable is going to show up. So Bernie Sanders is their dream guy. So Sanders supporters are people who have for a long time been disaffected from the Democrats. And now there is a crisis because many of them say they won't support Hillary if she gets the nomination. And some of them say we need a third party. But if they believed in that, there are already third and fourth and fifth and sixth parties in the country that people in most states can vote for. You can vote for the Greens or the Communists or the Social Worker Party, or you could help build one of those parties. You could talk about the National Black Independent Party that existed some 30 years ago. But it just shows you that people aren't really interested in change at all. And it's interesting to see how even people who are worthy of respect show that they too are afraid. They're afraid of change, or they don't want to put themselves on the line, or they're in denial about the nature of the Democrats, or they were just phonies and hypocrites all along. And I don't know which of these categories people like Angela Davis belong in, but she and other people have been, ever since the rise of Obama, making bizarre, foolish statements about him. And her dissent began when she ruined her good name by endorsing him in 2008. But she didn't just say she supported him. In 2010, for example, she made a strange claim that he hadn't raised a lot of money. She said he was elected despite the power of money. Now, she's a smart woman, so she must know that he raised four times as much as John McCain did in 2008. But having had that embarrassing experience, she and others now claim they're not in the endorsing business anymore. And this is what she said a couple of weeks ago, quote, "Endorsing, I don't endorse. But let me say, to be frank, I've never voted for one of the major parties until Barack Obama. I believe in independent politics. I think we need a new party, a party that is grounded in labor, a party that can speak to all of the issues around racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and what is happening in the world. We don't have that party yet." End quote. Well, as I said, we do have such parties. What are Davis and other people waiting for? Do they think someone's going to bestow a party on them? Or do they really not believe anything they say? And the truth is, they'll never leave the Democrats because they don't want to. They hope to see some kind of change somewhere, but nothing outside of the bounds of what they think is acceptable, and they don't want to put themselves on the line. Davis may have declined to endorse Sanders, but that silly doublespeak is emblematic of the Sanders phenomenon and why so many people are attracted to him. Sanders is the Obama of 2016. He has pulled off quite a marketing coup. He isn't a socialist, but markets himself as a socialist to people who also are not socialists, but they feel better thinking of themselves that way. So everyone is in on the big lie. The Sanders campaign website asked the question, are you ready to start a political revolution? Sanders is marketing the word revolution the same way he's marketing the word socialist. Revolution has different meanings, but voting for Democrats doesn't meet that definition by any standard anywhere. We know what revolutions look like. America had a revolution. It was a counterinsurgency to make sure that slavery would be safe should the British choose to end it. It was a reactionary revolution, but it was certainly a fundamental systemic change. Russia had a revolution, China had a revolution, Cuba had a revolution, Grenada attempted one. Ukraine had a right-wing revolution a couple of years ago, but you get the idea. There's nothing about voting for a liberalish Democrat that fits anyone's definition of a revolution. But you need not be involved in a struggle of those dimensions in order to be a revolutionary. It would be revolutionary to campaign against the Democratic Party or to work for a social movement that is not aligned with a political campaign. It would be revolutionary to keep campaigning against the current president, even though he has only 9 months left in office. Yes. Now, Barack Obama raises another problem with the Bernie-loving Hillary haters group. They rightly revile the Clintons about mass incarceration, welfare reform, killing Muammar Gaddafi, and any number of crimes, but none of them will raise their voice against Barack Obama, who is just as culpable as Hillary and Bill. Yeah. Obama could have freed thousands of black people imprisoned by the Clinton-era draconian drug sentencing laws, but he chose not to. The Fair Sentencing Act reduced the crack powder cocaine disparity, which put so many black people away for sometimes decades in prison. But it did nothing for those sentenced before its passage. Those people have no right to even request resentencing, in part because the Obama Justice Department filed court briefs against doing just that. Estimates vary, but Obama could have freed anywhere between 5,000 and 8,000 black people in one fell swoop. And having said that, I'm not going to hold my breath waiting for Black Lives Matter to take him on publicly or privately either. Why doesn't anyone protest when Obama speaks? He has contributed to the Clinton-era criminality, and he has done so without facing any of the hostility directed at the Clintons. It is true that as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton made war against Libya, killed its president, and then laughed about it on camera. But she worked for Barack Obama when the crime was carried out. She had his approval every step of the way. She pressured the Haitian government to lower the minimum wage from 62 cents to 30 cents an hour, but again, her boss gave the go-ahead. She and Obama claimed the right to carry out extrajudicial killings, even of Americans, and they killed Anwar al-Awlaki and his teenage son. And if that doesn't merit protest, I don't know what does. So now Sanders is the flavor of the month for liberals, and he has become so with little assist from black voters. So the blame game has begun in earnest by all those feeling the burn. What's wrong with black people? Don't they see he's wonderful? So black people shouldn't be voting for Hillary Clinton, but they shouldn't vote for Bernie either. He also makes appeals to the black community, as Glenn says, appearing as the more inclusive party when they're not. He knows how to seize on black people's concerns. We now have this phenomenon of the families of black lynching victims endorsing this one or that one. His campaign produced a video featuring Erica Garner, the daughter of the man whose murder we witnessed on television as he pleaded that he could not breathe. Yeah. Now, Ms. Garner is free to endorse him if she wants, but I don't see any evidence that killer police have any reason to fear a Sanders presidency. On his website, he says that, you know, the nonsense. Communities don't trust the police, law enforcement is disconnected, this is unacceptable. And then he says, we need a societal transformation to make it clear that black lives matter and racism will not be accepted. We don't need a societal transformation to end police brutality. We need a president who will use the power of the office to prosecute killer cops. But all he does is repeat trite phrases when he should be saying that he will empower the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department to bring justice. And he has this laundry list of trivialities: demilitarize the police, invest in community policing, increase civilian oversight, whatever that means, create a culture where the good cops can report on the bad cops, police forces should be diverse, a model training program, count how many people the police kill every year. But this can best be summed up as blah, blah, and blah. And this is the person that people are trying to see as some sort of a savior. So in effect, Sanders is Clinton and Obama all over again. Yes, Hillary Clinton made a groveling and bloodthirsty speech before the pro-Israel lobby at the AIPAC convention, while Sanders is more of a mealy-mouthed Zionist. But he also says, when asked, drones are okay, just don't use them so much. But he also said Hugo Chavez was a dead communist dictator. And the only true thing in that statement is Chavez is dead, but he wasn't a communist, he wasn't a dictator. He says Vladimir Putin has to be contained when it's the United States that has to be contained. But a lot of this love for Sanders is an attempt to assuage guilt from supporting Clinton and Obama. After having destroyed, Obama was interviewed in the Atlantic magazine, the Obama Doctrine, and has his face on the cover looking, you know, like a model or something. And he said, after destroying Libya, we, with the help of jihadists like ISIS, we're now told are the enemy, he blames Britain and France for the whole mess. There certainly is no honor among thieves. And in this interview, it's said that he privately refers to Libya as the shitstorm. Like, it's got nothing to do with him. Somebody just messed up somewhere. But where's the outrage? Why nickname Hillary as Killery, but not find a pithy name for the killer Barack Obama? Bill and Hillary are so easy to hate, but it isn't easy to explain why he was elected and reelected with so much enthusiasm for black people. His racist statements and hers are no worse than Obama's. Obama used dog whistle politics and talked over black people's heads straight to white people. There's no reason to hate her for the same behavior exhibited by him. But his Clinton's ability to get away with putting black people in jail or ending what was once a 60-year right to public assistance has to be examined. How did most of us say nothing or even applaud these actions? The truth is that black people, led by the misleaders, also revel in respectability politics and were eager to join white people in beating up the poor and with disastrous consequences. It's easy to point fingers now, but it is much easier to call names at the Clinton and then to ask why they succeeded with so little opposition from black people. It's easier to say feel the burn than to ask why accommodation and self-hatred were the order of the day and black people in jail or on public assistance were so readily despised by so many of us. But we're propagandized about a lot of things, and we're propagandized into voting and dissuaded from doing anything else. Black people in particular are taught to worship the act of voting and not to respect the movement politics which accomplished so much. What are we told every 4 years? We're reminded that people died so we might have the right to vote. Yes, people died in the struggle against America's apartheid, when it included the right to the franchise, but I don't think they died so that we could fall for the same foolishness every 4 years. They died for our freedom and for our citizenship rights. So as Glenn Plunt pointed out, there's nothing wrong with watching the two parties fall apart. In fact, there's a lot of reason to be happy. Trump's campaign may lead to an end of the Republicans as we know them. Hillary could provide more of the same unless the Sanders people make good in their pledge to bolt the party if she wins the nomination, but I'm doubtful about their willingness to fight. Their opposition to her has taken on cartoonist overtones. In Arizona recently, Arizona cut 70% of its polling places, and as intended, the result was chaos on primary day. But Arizona was one of those states that had to get permission from the Justice Department to make any election changes. But the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act, and which ended that requirement. Did the Sanders people talk about the Supreme Court and how their guy would change it? No. Did they talk about making voting a constitutional right? No. They said somehow Hillary Clinton was behind it all, even though Arizona is a red state. But that's about as much as they amount to. So in closing, I'm getting a sign. So early in the campaign season, our Black Agenda Report editor, Bruce Dixon, called Bernie Sanders a sheepdog, and he predicted that he would play the role of other liberals in presidential campaign. They create an excitement for the purpose of keeping progressives in the party, but in the end, they always endorse the nominee. And Bruce and the rest of Barr took some heat for that, and people were offended, and how dare we say such a thing. But just 2 days ago, Sanders was asked if he'll endorse Clinton if she wins the nomination, and he said, sure I will. Look, as I've said a million times, I think the idea of a Trump or a Cruz presidency would be a disaster. I'll do everything in my power and work as hard as I can to make sure that doesn't happen. And if she's a nominee, I'll support her. So there you have it. Democrat after Democrat, demeaning, insulting, imprisoning black people, none of them willing to fight on our behalf, And we pay the price in continuing down the same old rabbit hole time and time again. So at closing, I'll just say this. There is no self-determination with Bernie Sanders or anyone else in the quadrennial duopoly sham. Thank you very much.
That was Margaret Kimberly, senior columnist for Black Agenda Report. Boston-based writer and activist Danny Haifong is a regular contributor to Barr. In a recent article, Haifong said the fractures in the Republican and Democratic parties are reflections of the general crisis in the system of capitalism.
You know, I think Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump could not have arisen to the tide of popularity that they've received in any other moment than now. U.S. imperialism is coming off of its post-Obama stupor. There is a political vacuum that needs to be filled to manage the affairs of the imperialist system. And what seems to be happening is an internal revolt within the two-party corporate duopoly. And what I mean by that is that while the U.S. ruling class, the parasitic ruling class of its various institutions, from the military to its economic base, seems to almost be at a loss as to what to do now that its most effective evil that it could have created to manage the post-2008 crisis is leaving. So there is this political vacuum that Sanders and Trump has filled to almost appeal to the legitimate grievances that both bases of the respective two-party corporate duopoly represents. There's the persistent joblessness, the poverty of the free trade agreements, the never-ending Wall Street speculation that 8 years of a Democratic Party presidency didn't rein in. And here comes Sanders basically using the rhetoric of Occupy Wall Street to, you know, honestly surge in popularity over the course of the 2016 elections. And then you have Donald Trump, who has received the most attention from the American left up until this point, whether it's because some believe he's a fascist or, you know, he makes some sexist or racist remark about Mexicans or women. But also he has really captivated a Republican Party base that has been promised, especially the poor and working class Republican Party base who have been promised over the last 30 years, starting in the Reagan era or, you know, arguably the Nixon era, that really supporting white supremacy will be of material and economic benefit to the Republican Party voters. And, you know, 40 years later in 2016, what we see is capitalism and imperialism have no ability to do that. And these voters are angry. Donald Trump has channeled that anger in a cartoonish way. The corporate media has been all over it to rake in the profits from his cartoonish and very non-PC way of talking. But, you know, what remains the reality of the two-party corporate duopoly is that regardless of who wins, what really matters is that this election period has opened up such a wider space for political debate and discourse that the 8 years of the Obama administration suppressed through its bipartisan consensus on all of the issues that are being argued about right now, including foreign policy. And none of the candidates have great foreign policy positions. But as you write, Donald Trump is arguably to the left of all of them because he's the only one who's condemning NATO and he's the only one who is saying in a concrete way that the U.S. military and its empire must be reined in if any of the promises that Sanders or Trump promotes are going to be achieved. So it's a very interesting time. And of course, we shouldn't believe anything that these politicians actually say because in the final analysis, imperialism only works for one class, and that's the capitalist class. But it is really important to pay attention to the nuances of this period because there is more room to operate, and we have to be attentive to that in our work on the ground.
You say that Trump and Sanders are not in and of themselves, that is, as personalities, threats to the two-party duopoly system. But the Republican Party seems headed towards a rupture, and something similar could happen in the Democratic Party. How is the duopoly not threatened?
I think what I meant by that is what these candidates represent is really what is the threat, because if either of these candidates end up winning the election, the general election, they will ultimately have to serve the very class, the very capitalist class of Wall Street, the military contractors, the banks, in order to operate. And I think what really has the two parties unraveling right now is the ideas that these candidates are promoting are what really is the threat to the imperialist system. So you have on the Republican Party side an unpredictable candidate in Trump, and on the Democratic Party side, a candidate who is really only receiving grassroots support from unions and from individual donations. And both of these candidates happen to be gaining in popularity because of their ideas. And if these ideas become popular, then there is the potential for a greater rebellion. And I think what the two-party corporate duopoly, the establishment, is having trouble dealing with is how to squash what these candidates represent while at the same time not angering the very bases that are being energized by these campaigns. And at this moment, it doesn't seem like anything is working. As Sanders is becoming more popular in the polls, and Trump, no matter how many so-called corporate media mistakes he makes, how many statements he is condemned for by the corporate media, and when it comes to his positions on, you know, reproductive rights or whatever it may be, torture, he still wins because his base is strong within the Republican Party grassroots. So these candidates, their ideas are what really is the threat, because at the end of the day, when they become president, we still have the imperialist system to fight and the crisis that it is creating for masses of people.
President Trump or a President Sanders might not do a damn thing to dismantle capitalism or imperialism, but a losing candidate Trump and a losing candidate Sanders might do some damage to the two ends of the duopoly system in terms of the reaction of their followers.
Definitely. And that is what we have to be paying attention to. I think the U.S. electoral corporate duopoly cycle every 4 years tends to breed and energize the most reactionary anti-intellectual sentiments among all forces in the United States, from the left to the right, from the grassroots to the establishment. And I think what we have to be most attentive to and really putting into practice in our, you know, on the ground organizing is, you know, how are we talking to people about these elections, as undoubtedly the followers of Sanders, who have very progressive sentiments, a lot of the sentiments that Sanders represents are from the Occupy movement, which of course had its flaws, but it also, you know, changed the narrative of how a lot of people think about Wall Street and the present condition that many young people find themselves in, especially. And even with Trump, we have to have a very objective position when it comes to Trump, because while some on the left may be very enticed to condemn him as a fascist, we also have to engage with the folks who have been attracted to him based on principles that the left should be thinking about and adopting when it comes to opposing NATO, when it comes to opposing unmitigated U.S. imperial warfare all over the world. Those are positions that the left traditionally has adopted and forwarded in its work historically. But today, we have someone like Trump who is the most, or at least, advertised and on the surface, the most anti-war candidate, when we should know that all U.S. presidents in the history of this country have always been on the side of war, have always been on the side of plunder. So we need to be objective and really be talking to people about this, because, you know, there is a lot of, I feel, simmering unrest that could potentially explode as the establishment, as the bourgeoisie, as the ruling class begins to implement, you know, its various means to erase its least desired candidates, which right now are Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
Donald Trump seems to be offering what he would think is a smart deal. Sanders is offering a replication of the New Deal, but you say that all of it is for naught because imperialism can't provide any kind of deal for working people in the United States.
Exactly. I've been writing extensively for BIR and for other sources about what exactly the character of imperialism is today and why imperialism over the last 40 years has not only devastated the planet, all regions of the world through its military and economic plunder sponsored by multinational corporations and banks, but also why domestically within the centers of empire, why has the West and the United States attacked workers as a whole, the working class generally? Because there was once a moment in prior and up to World War II where there was a section of workers, especially white workers, that were able to win substantial material benefits from the imperialist system through struggle, and thus there was a material basis for their support in that system. And that's why, for example, Ho Chi Minh would, you know, try to campaign to the French working class and say, come to our side, fight colonialism. But it was very difficult because, you know, the French working class benefited from colonialism. Today, that is no longer the case. Today, the U.S. imperialism is outstretched. It has reached a point where overproduction and the cost of maintaining the system is becoming a drag on production. Production is slowing, it's stagnating, and thus in order to maintain profits and expand profits, the exploitation has been increased astronomically. That's why we see wealth and income and wages in sharp decline year after year. Unemployment numbers that are mere lies year after year, debt, rising levels of student debt, you know, rising levels of mass black incarceration. These are all symptoms of the general crisis of imperialism that is showing no signs of recovery. And that is mainly because the imperialist system has no means to provide a recovery for a section of workers while at the same time exploiting these same workers for the surplus value, the profit that it so desperately needs. And so really we're at a dead end situation. We're at imperialism and capitalism at a dead end. And regardless of which candidate, if Sanders were to win, his New Deal program could never be implemented in such a historical epic. So there are so many opportunities right now to really intensify the on-the-ground struggle, the working class struggle, the struggle for revolutionary transformation, because all of these contradictions are set to sharpen and have the potential to turn into antagonisms rather rapidly.
Your analysis in this article focuses chiefly on Sanders and Trump, but you do raise the question of whether Hillary Clinton might be the most dangerous candidate in the race.
Yes. Hillary Clinton comes out of the last 8 years of the Obama tradition. She was a Secretary of State for 4 years, and in those 4 years, she was instrumental in the destabilization of Libya, instrumental in the sponsoring of jihadists in Syria, has always been an avid supporter of Zionist Israeli expansion in Palestine. And her economic record, her record in service of the bourgeoisie, is far more extensive than even a Donald Trump. And so what makes her the most dangerous is that she represents the weaker version of the more effective evil strategy that U.S. imperialism has employed over the last 8 years of Obama. She represents the liberal face of imperialism. And honestly, most of her policies are to the right of Donald Trump when it comes to the massive military-industrial complex that the Obama administration and administrations before him have employed all over the world. So when I was talking about why United front against Trump is very dangerous is because it has the potential to empower Hillary Clinton into office, where she will only intensify a lot of the policies of the Obama administration, which are actually the material manifestation of what Trump has been saying in a lot of ways, whether that's the militarization of the U.S.-Mexican border, whether that's the intensification of the massive drone program that has murdered thousands of people all over the Muslim world, or whether this comes to police brutality. Trump may be, you know, a racist, and his supporters may punch black people who are in these rallies, but it's Hillary Clinton who has sponsored and promoted the most draconian and white supremacist laws and policies around police brutality that massively expanded the mass black incarceration state. So that is why she is the most dangerous, is because her entire political career has been in service to the very forces that control this country. And she was, from day one, the number one choice of the ruling class.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.